Mr. Nurse, Real 2. We're talking about when you joined two troops, C Squadron, 2nd Fighting 4th Yeomanry at Chippenham Camp, Cambridgeshire, round about December 1942. Just to start, perhaps going through some of the key figures, what about Nairn? He was quite a figure in C Troop. He was the Major Nairn.
That's right, yeah.
What did you think of him, and what sort of a squadron leader was he, in your view?
I would think he was a very good squadron leader. He was a somewhat outlandish character with his huge handlebars moustache and his shillelagh and his silver cigarette case, and he looked like a sack of coal tied in the middle. He wasn't a smart soldier, but I don't think he knew the meaning of fear. But I never had to see him face it, of course. But and a very rich man, incidentally, Nairn Nolonium.
Was he? Did he have the common touch? I mean, did his men?
I wouldn't think he was terribly popular. I don't say he was hated, but I don't think he was terribly popular.
And how was he with you? Was he efficient?
Yes, I would say so.
Because the reason I ask is he was in the end replaced for one reason or another.
I should never know the reason for that, I'm afraid. But he was still a squadron commander with the 79th Armoured Division.
As far as you were concerned, he was a reasonably competent officer.
Yes, I would say so.
Well, what about your troop officer? Do you remember?
Well, officer was Dickie, at that time was Dickie Leith, Major. He eventually became Major Leith and the officer commanding the squadron. But it was Richard Leith, first lieutenant at that time.
And what was he like?
A very nice guy, very anti-communist. He's a landowner. And funnily enough, I think he came from Leith. I think he was a sort of gentleman farmer up there. He was a very pleasant guy.
And competent?
Yes, I would say so. Yeah.
What about the other young officers? Had Workman arrived by then? Charles Workman?
I think he probably had.
Would you know much about him? Or
no. My only one couple I know about are my own commander, which was Eric Anderson Lamont, of whom you probably heard, and one or two other officers whose names I've forgotten, but who were quite competent. Lamont was the best.
What was Lamont like?
It was a love-hate relationship, quite honestly, Peter. He was, during the fighting, of course, it was a Bob and Sir. He called me Bob, I had to call him Sir, obviously. And at one time we had a wrestling match together, which he just about beat me. But he was a very competent officer. Later on, I should be able to tell you some of the things. He got the Military Cross, as you may know.
What about the hate side?
Well, he's a bit too ruthless.
Did that come out then, at Chippenham, or was that more later?
No, came out later.
How did you feel about him at Chippenham?
Well, let me think. Did he join at Chippenham? I'm not sure that he did. I think he joined in, what's that place on the North Sea coast? Where?
Rudston.
Yes, I think it was probably at Rudston, yes.
That's okay. So, any NCOs that stand out? Bill Scott, I think, was one.
Yeah. He wasn't C Squadron. Well, he was at one time. He was initially he was NA Squadron, and I think he came to C in reconnaissance. And then there was a guy called Bill Fenwick, who I got on very well with, a sergeant. Another corporal called...
What was he like, Bill Fenwick?
Very big, tough character. Very, very nice guy indeed. Strong as an ox. His sister was a sister or a matron in one of the Bristol hospitals. Married to a very beautiful red-headed girl.
And what were the NCOs like? Were they?
Oh, they were okay. Two troops NCOs were okay.
Not the shouting sort that you'd had?
No. Completely different.
And
So there was Bill Fenwick, Warden. I forget who the Lance Corporal was now. I've forgotten completely. But Warden was the troop corporal and Fenwick the troop sergeant.
And lastly, the Colonel, Alex Scott. He was very junior. He was the Colonel. Did you have any impression of what he was like?
We hardly ever. The only time I ever saw him was when I attended as a witness to a court martial. He was very. I think he was. He was probably. Though I think he was awarded to DSO, I'm not sure of that. But he was probably a captain in the cavalry at the end of the First World War, and maybe reached major rank, and then suddenly was presented with a regiment of tanks, which he knew nothing about. But he was competent enough. But as I say, one saw him occasionally at a certain parade. And a little voice, regiment, what was it? 2nd, 5th and 4th R Imperial Yeomanry, attention, you could hardly hear him. There's 900 men there, probably. Now, a great horseman, by the way.
Were horses still important?
Probably to him. I did my riding after the war, so...
Now, what about this question of it being a Scottish unit, how did they make, you were an Englishman, an Englishman with a fair English accent as well, a regional English accent, how did you fit in? Did they make you welcome? And
there was no problem as far as I remember.
No problem.
Yes, there was a little bit of joshing from the Scottish lads. They thought of us as Sassenachs, probably not fully civilised. But apart from that, there was no serious problem.
Well, the porridge thing, was that real? You mentioned it earlier. Is this actually... Because I've not been able to find whether it was a joke or not.
No, it wasn't really a joke. Yes, it wasn't a joke. They really did put porridge in the... put salt in the porridge. I don't know whether they put bromide in the tea, but they certainly put salt in the porridge.
And it was not to your taste?
That was not to my taste.
And did you complain? Because there must have been at least half English by the end.
I would think about a third. I'm only guessing, but I would think about a third. Oh, I certainly didn't. Whether anyone else did, I don't know.
Now, when you got there, what tank were you in, and what was your job within the tank crew? Because I don't think they've got the Shermans then.
No, we had Crusaders. In fact, we had Covenanters and Crusaders. Covenanters becoming before Crusaders.
Which were you in?
Crusader.
And could you describe the Crusader and what everybody's job was in it?
Well, it was at that time it was a cruiser tank, weighed about 16 tons, speaking from memory. It was originally armed with a 2-pounder gun, and then it was upgunned to a 6-pounder, as far as I remember. It was very lightly armoured. I mean, a Mark IV, even a Mark III could knock it out. I think it had a crew of 4. Commander, gunner, driver, and operator loader. It may have been 5, but I think it was 4. 4-man crew. It was a very fast tank. Whether its speed was ever used to advantage in the desert, I don't know. Because I don't think it was used after the desert campaign. Certainly wasn't used in Northwest Europe.
You were just training in
it? Yeah, exactly. Until we took over the Shermans.
And do you remember whose crew you were put into? The composition of your first crew?
I think it was a corporal. I was a troop corporal's gunner at that time. Corporal Tippett, I think his name was. T-P-T-T. I'm sure it was.
And do you remember any of the others in your first crew?
There was a guy called Millard, Taffy Millard, whose daddy was a News of the World correspondent in Cardiff or Swansea.
What was he? Driver?
He was a radio operator. He was a grammar school boy. He was a radio operator loader. And I don't remember the other crew members, quite honestly, because it didn't last very long.
And yourself? So yep. There was only one other. And you were the gunner, were you?
Yep.
And what was the role of gunner? Can you just describe what you did and what the layout of the turret was in the Crusader?
In the crew, with the 2-pounder gun, you had full traverse, of course, and quite a bit of elevation and depression. And you had a shoulder piece. You had to put your right shoulder into this leather-padded shoulder piece to depress and elevate the gun. And, of course, you had the optics, the peritelescope. And we did sort of mock attacks, things of that sort with these things. But we didn't have them very long. That was, I was about to tell you about reverse steering. I mean, I volunteered with Don Molyneux, who was Major Nichols' driver, gunner, to take a tank down to Bridlington. We were just expecting the Shermans, you see. Shut me up if you want. We're just expecting the Shermans, so I volunteered to drive this thing under command of Lance Corporal Molyneux. And there was a very steep hill living out of that village. Rudston, was it you mentioned? Towards Bridlington. And I got reverse steering halfway down, which meant that I pulled the right thing that went to the left. And I was juggling like this as the tank was going, 16 tons of tank going down a really steep hill. Eventually I got control of it and we got it on the flatbeds in Bridlington Station.
Could you explain what reverse steering, how was it called?
I honestly don't know how it occurs, but it's a warning that's given to all Crusader drivers. Don't get involved with reverse steering. I don't know how it occurs, I really don't. Not now, I probably knew at the time.
Now, that was a bit later when you were up at Rudston near Bridlington.
Yeah,
it's just outside.
That's right, yeah.
But that's right. Now, did you remember going to the Liney Head firing range at that time?
Where is that? Is that not in... I don't know. It doesn't track...
Firing.
The only range I remember is in Kirkcouver in Scotland.
That's a bit later, yeah. What about... there was a question of you being sent on active service to North Africa.
Oh, yes.
Do you remember about that?
Yes, I remember it now. You might be a little bit interested in this, because I think some of the tanks had already been put on ship in Liverpool. And I went sick with swellings in my face. So I went up to the medical officer with a Captain Beamish. No one's ever heard of him since, but he looks me up and down, and he gets on the phone and asks for Alistair Spencer Lane. "Afraid I've got some bad news for you, Alistair." And I thought, what the hell's the matter with me? And of course it was mumps. So that put an end to that. I mean, the whole squadron, if not the regiment, were put under quarantine. Well, not under quarantine, but were examined every day by their medical officer. And I was sent to a very nice civilian cottage hospital with a lovely little matron, a ward to myself, and next to each side of me, two other ATS girls who also had mumps. And it was the best fortnight I've had in hospital. Or one of the best.
And do you reckon that caused the cancellation?
Well,
that
apparently it did, yeah. Because it is very contagious, isn't it?
Were you sorry to lose the opportunity to go to North Africa?
No. Or
why not? Because, I mean, it's a common sense thing not to be pleased not to go into action. But the unit history makes out that the men were very disappointed that they weren't going into action. Could you tell us what the ordinary chap like yourself really thought?
I think secretly they were quite pleased. I mean, I suppose they're the sort of, what's the word I want, macho characters. I know one or two of them, I'll tell you about if you want to know it. Who can't wait to get to the Hun, but I think that most of them were secretly pleased. Because, you know, a delay, the war might be over tomorrow or next week.
Now, one thing they did do was, because they didn't go, they stayed in England and got assigned to the D-Day unit.
Yep.
Well, not the, you know, the Northwest Europe.
Yep.
But they found that the men were getting bored with training. There's a big recreational program started. Now, so they say. Do you remember any of the things that they did to try and entertain you during 1943?
I never knew they did entertain us. No, I've no memory of it at all.
The other policy they had was of everyone learnt everybody else's job.
Oh yes.
Was that you'd started that in a sense when you were at Barnard Castle?
Yeah,
that something that went on?
That went on. As I say, everyone could do. Drivers could handle the guns, and loaders could handle the guns and drive, and etc. 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 I mean, I've done all the jobs in the tank except command, not in wartime anyway.
Now, you moved to Rudston in June 1943. That's anything else about Chippenham? And, oh, you went to Newbury as well.
Yeah.
Well, it's near. It's next. Anything else there before you left?
At Chippenham?
Yeah.
Not that I can remember, no. Blah, 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 blah. No, doesn't stand out in my memory very. We weren't there terribly long anyway.
Now, Rudston, you went there in June 1943, and that's where you got the Shermans.
That's correct, yes.
And I'd like to talk about the Sherman, because this is obviously very important. Could you take me through the whole tank in as much detail as you remember, what you thought of it, what its characteristics were, and what it was like to do every job in it?
Well, it was downside improvement on the Crusader, in as much as it was a cleaner, and there was more room in it. It was a cleaner turret design. It was 33 tons, as you probably know. It had a top speed of about 30 miles an hour. Its armour was still much thinner than at least two of the German tanks, if not three of them. 75mm low-velocity gun. It was a nice tank to drive. It was left-hand drive, as you can imagine. It was a nice tank to drive. I've driven quite a few miles in them. And the gunnery was comparatively simple. It also mounted a 50-caliber Browning gun on the turret for anti-aircraft use, most of which were dumped into ditches when we got across the road, across the pond.
And it had a hull Browning?
It had a hull Browning, 30-caliber, yes.
Now, let's just go through it. What was it like to drive? I mean, what controls did you have?
The usual steering sticks, obviously, and a very long gear. I think it had about 8 gears, as far as I remember. It had certainly more than 4 gears, but I liked it as a driver.
How did you use the... I mean, I didn't ask you before, so it's saving it, but how did you use the two sticks to control?
Well,
people don't understand that.
All right, so you wanted to turn to the right. To the left. You pull the left-hand stick back. That locks the track, and the right-hand stick just drives you. Well, you could turn the thing on a sixpence if you were careful. On its own lead, anyway.
And did it sounds that, but did it have brakes?
No. As far as I remember, no. The steering sticks
were the brakes.
So when you part, you had them back fully. Usual clutch and accelerator, obviously. Though the one thing about the first one we had, stop me if it's boring you, it had an unusual petrol engine, which is another fault with ours here, because the Americans had diesels, but ours were petrol. Yes, the particular tank, first Sherman we had, was obviously intended for the Russian front, because all the instructions in the turret were in Kyrillic or Cyrillic characters. But its engine was five Packard engines, six-cylinder Packard engines, grouped together. So you had six cylinders, six coils, six this, six of that, and they were not very reliable.
In what way? What was the main problem?
Well, if say one coil went down or one carburetor went down, you lost a lot of power immediately. We had this happen in Normandy, as it happens.
And that were all of them these five engines, these linked engines?
As far as I'm aware, they were at that time, yes.
So that was another thing about them. Now, what about the job of... let's go through the crew. We looked at the driver. Mm. What was the driving seat like? I mean, was it comfortable? I mean, where was it comfortable to see out of? And
it was there was no comfort in the tank, really. But yes, it was all right. You could raise and lower it as you needed to. If you were driving with the flap off, you could sort of raise it so that you had a good forward vision. Or you can take it right down to close the cannon, drive through the either the periscope or a visor.
Was that more difficult to drive using that?
Funnily enough, I've never driven in action, so I really don't know, but I would say it was.
Now, what about the co-driver? I presume you had to practice being co-driver. So what would you say the job of the co-driver was? Because it didn't seem to be much of a job.
Handling the 30-caliber machine gun and making the tea and spreading margarine on the biscuits.
So out of action, nothing. Helping.
That's right, yeah.
And what was the... Did you ever fire them? Were you familiar with the Browning? And what did you think of it as a gun?
How can I put it? Initially, it was quite a good gun, but the barrel wore out rather quickly, as far as I remember. The rifling went down rather quickly. But, I mean, if you were going to fire a sustained burst, that would happen to practically any machine gun, I would think. Most short bursts of the answer with machine guns.
You could change it from the inside, couldn't you?
Yeah, yes, you could. Yeah.
Do you remember how you did it? Because you couldn't do that with a British tank, I don't believe.
I'm not sure about that. I really don't know. But you could, yes, you could certainly pull the... You mean change the barrel? I've never had to do it, and I don't remember. We carry spare barrels.
Right, so that's not something that's important. What about the job of the wireless operator? Although you didn't like it, it was mainly... it wasn't Morse code that were using.
Well, we never used Morse code, quite frankly.
So would you be able to be wireless operator, or did you ever take the role on?
Oh, yes, I did.
What can you run through what the wireless operator did?
Well, at first light, he'd have to, the squadron leader would, or the troop leader, and then eventually the squadron leader would get every outstation, every tank on a similar net, and which was not exactly easy. You had to understand the set, or the controls anyway, to get it on. And then, of course, he was the loader as well.
Now, before we got... There were two... The wireless had two functions, didn't it?
It had three. Intercom... Sorry, I'm...
Yeah, yes. If you go through that, that'd be very helpful.
Well, it had...
Hurry on.
It had A set, B set, and IC. A set was the long-range thing, maybe 25 miles. B set was about 2 miles, and IC, obviously, internal communication. Some people forget what they were on, or forgot what they were on.
Could that lead to embarrassment?
Good. And did on one or two occasions.
Perhaps you'll mention it, you know.
Yeah.
And his job was loader.
Yeah.
Now, what about the layout of the turret and where the ammunition was stored? This would be the sort of loader stroke gunners.
Well, you had vertical bins, each carrying one round in the turret, and also rounds under the floor of the turret. I think she carried about, 76 rounds, something of that sort. I've really forgotten.
And what types of ammunition did you have? What choices?
High explosive and armor-piercing. Later on, of course, they had HEATs and ballistic something and a something cap. I've forgotten it all now.
And these were stored in the bins and down below?
And down below. Horizontally below the floorboards and vertically in the turret.
And whose job... So the loader, what was the actual load? Take us through firing a typical round. What would happen?
Well, in theory, the rule was the commander would sight a target, and he'd say, wherever it was, gunner traverse left and steady on, if he thought. He had a rough sight on the top of the turret, you see, so he knew more or less when the gun was pointing. And then he'd say, load AG if it was a machine gun post, or load AP if it was a tank or an anti-tank gun, mostly AG with an anti-tank gun. And then he'd call range, so it would be... say Gunner Travers left, steady on, 2,000 load HE and fire.
Now, that's the firing orders. Now, what would be what was the procedure with the breach and the ammunition?
Frankly, in action, when there was usually a round of some sort up the breach anyway.
So having fired it,
it was a semi-automatic cannon. In other words, it ejected, but the loader then had to get the next round out of one of the bins, throw it in, and get his fingers out of the way. And
who would shut the breach? The loader.
It shut automatically. There was what's known as a breach mechanism, you see. Initially, you'd take down the breach mechanism to open the breach. You put the shell in, and it caught on a couple of paws and closed automatically. But incidentally, the first thing you must do is get the breech mechanism lever back to its original position, otherwise you break something, you break an arm or something. And then it's fired and it's ejected automatically, but it's not a fully automatic. Well, they have fully automatic weapons now, I believe, but these were a semi-automatic.
So, and then how did you actually fire it?
There was a button arrangement there. You could select, you could select AP for and HE. Obviously, HE was a lower velocity. And you had a button, there was little switches, I remember. The gunner sat on the left-hand side, and there was a little switch, not much bigger than that. And you pressed forward for probably HE, and back for AP, something of that sort. Forgive my memory, but it was something of that. There were three positions.
And that was it?
Yeah.
What was it like when it went off?
Bang. No, it was...
How big? I mean...
It was worse outside, I would suggest, than inside. The problem was, of course, there were... The cordite, I mentioned cordite just now, but that was a very acrid smell when a 75mm round goes off. It's acrid when a pistol goes off, but...
So the fumes would fill the turret?
No, they were extractors.
And what about the noise? Was it... How deafening was it?
Well, we all had earphones on, so it didn't affect us very much.
And... So that's the job. Any other jobs that the gunner had to do?
Maintain the guns, clean them all, of course.
Tell me about that. Because it's quite a job, isn't it? How did you clean the guns?
Well, the cannon, we had a long ramrod, and we used to... obviously, we had to get out of the tank, go to the front, obviously make sure the breech was clear, and shove this thing right through the bore, and work it, don't you, to clean all the fouling off. And, of course, the machine gun had to be taken out. They were quite simple to dismantle and clean. Lightly oiled. What was the old Tory about? He liked it to be like his favourite girlfriend. Clean, lightly oiled.
And that's clean. So any other jobs?
Not really, no.
And what about the role of the commander? Now, that's the job that you didn't do so much. But
no.
What was his job? You've said, obviously, give fire orders. We've done that. But what was it? What was the rest of his job?
Well, you're talking about a troop commander or a tank commander?
I mean a tank commander, really.
A tank commander.
We'll come to troop commander, because you were in a troop commander's tank later. But
well, he obviously had to know map reading. He had to know wireless procedure to communicate with either his own troop or even the squadron leader. Map reading was, I suppose, the most important thing he had to do. And to be observant, I'm talking about in action now, to see if you can see anything that's going to hurt you. And then get the guns pushed onto it.
Now, what about training in tank tactics? Because they developed some various things, like being hold down and turret down and hurry up. Could you explain some of these things that you practiced before you went out, rather than things you learned when you were out there?
Hull down is a situation where just the turret and obviously the gun is able to fire. Turret down, you wouldn't fight with turret down unless you wanted to hide the tank completely, obviously. But Bill Scott, Sergeant Bill Scott, he was wonderful. We were doing an exercise on Yorkshire Moors, and he was coming towards, he was advancing as an enemy, and getting the... So say, taking a bead on him, and he suddenly disappeared. And he'd seen a little dip in the ground and driven his tank straight into him, boom, like that. He was completely out of sight. And he got a lot of kudos for that from the officer commanding. That's a whole bunch. Sometimes we'd have bulldozers drawn up to create a hull down position for us.
Any other tactics that you practice?
Not really, no. It was very.
Now, what about this? You mentioned it before when you went up to Scotland to Kirkcudbright tank range.
Yep.
What exactly happened there?
I think we must have been in Bridlington then. I remember we went out by Carlisle, and it was a horrible day, wet and grey, and we used to fire at targets on the ridge in front of us, and if any shots went over, they made sure that there were no fishing boats or anything like that in the area. But it was the first real firing experience with 75 millimeters we'd had. And they were very accurate guns for what it's worth. Unfortunately, they didn't have the muzzle velocity.
And what do you think your standard of gunnery was like then as compared to what it became later? I mean,
well, the 75 millimeter.
No, I mean, the ability to hit what you were aiming at.
It was comparatively easy. It depended upon if you were given the correct range, of course. I mean, it's a very flat, an armor-piercing shell goes on a very flat trajectory. But if you're given the wrong range, it might fall short by 100 yards, 50 yards, or go over by 100 or 50 yards. In fairness, we were usually given 1,000 yards, so we set the reticules for 1,000 yards, and we damaged the targets considerably.
Now, the other thing, there were a couple of major exercises, but perhaps we'll just talk about the exercise on the moors. One was Blackcock and the other one was Eagle. Now, you might not remember them separately.
I remember Blackcock, because once again, the weather was dreadful. They even issued us with rum. It was that bad.
And what were you doing? Tell me about it.
Well, as far as I remember, we were perhaps one squadron was used as an enemy and one as a friend, and sort of trying to get around each other. I don't remember too. All I remember is the weather and the rum, quite honestly.
And
everyone hated it.
There's quite a lot of endurance training being mixed in with those exercises. You know, in other words, to test you under war conditions.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was amazing. No one got colds then, or chilblains, or anything of that sort. Really, quite tough.
Another thing is that round about this time, Major Nairn left. And Major, Chris Nichols,
yeah.
I think the answer is no, but were you aware of why that had happened? Because
it's
partly a policy of introducing desert veterans, mm-hmm. but did you know at the time why Nairn had gone, and how did you feel about it?
Well, I didn't feel too sad about it, because Chris Nichols, to my mind, was a far nicer person. Though I didn't have much contact with him, obviously. I was only a trooper then.
What did you think of Nichols? What was he like? Because he wasn't with you long, because he was killed early.
Yeah, I know. Sorry. Yes, he was a very nice man, as far as I was aware. I think he did rather well in the desert, but of course he was killed. Otherwise, he has no known grave in Normandy.
How did he compare to Nairn? In what way was he just?
Well, he was battle experience. That's the main difference. It was battle experience from the desert, whereas Nairn had no battle experience.
And that showed, did it?
I would say so. Yeah.
Did he show any signs of nerves from his desert experiences? I mean, that you'd noticed?
No, I wasn't close enough to him to know that, quite honestly.
What about the waterproofing?
Oh, the tanks.
The Shermans had to be waterproofed.
That was done in Aldershot, just not long before D-Day.
You went to Aldershot in, I think, March 1944. What do you think of Aldershot when you got there? It's the first time you've been there.
Not a lot. They were sort of Victorian cavalry barracks. The only thing is, my window of the room we had overlooked the local cinema, and there was about 50 yards away, and there was an usherette there I lusted after. Probably just as well I never met her.
And, tell me about the waterproofing. How was it done? Would you help?
Yeah.
How were they doing it? Because it was quite a complicated, it wasn't just a simple thing, was it, waterproofing a Sherman?
No, it wasn't, but ours wasn't a swimming tank. I mean, I don't remember an awful lot about that, I'm ashamed to say. I remember when we landed, but I don't remember much about the actual waterproof. I know it was done in the tank park in Aldershot, and I know Pitt Roberts, the commander, divisional commander, came round and spoke to everybody, and it was a mucky job.
What did you use?
It's called now. Some sort of rubbery stuff. I forgot what it's called now. I used to know. I forgot what it's called.
Where were you putting it? Do you remember?
All over the turret ring. Obviously, the gun had to be protected, and the engine cover had to be waterproofed. I think they put extensions on the exhausts. I'm not sure about that. And I think there was also an arrangement where, whether that happened to our tanks or to the swimming tanks, where you could blow, as soon as you landed on the beach, you could blow it off by explosive.